Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, June 18th, 2020. We'll start with an article on the front page, headlined, DeWitt County, You Move On to Hope. Services to be held on lawn of fire-damaged Clinton Church, by Garrett Karsten and Kevin Barlow. Clinton. Pastor Nick Blackledge never imagined he'd see his church in flames, and the same sentiments were shared by members of his congregation. I think they were very overwhelmed and a lot of tears were shed, Blackledge said, once they learned their church, Clinton Assembly of God Church, was on fire and at risk of being destroyed. Then you move on once you realize there's no saving it. You move on to hope. The Clinton Fire Department was called to the church at 801 South Mulberry at 8:19 a.m. Tuesday, and remained on the scene until 3:47 p.m. Blake West, an engineer for the fire department, said Wednesday the cause of the fire remains undetermined, but added there was nothing to indicate it was intentional. Church officials met Wednesday and decided to hold a service Sunday at 10:30 a.m. on the property's front yard under a tent and with 200 provided chairs for seating. According to Blackledge, no plans are definitive beyond Sunday, but they intend to hold future services indoors soon, most likely using another facility. Church board members plan to meet Saturday to discuss how to begin repairing and rebuilding damaged structures. The pastor said insurance estimates are being gathered to calculate the total amount of damage sustained from the fire, and the next step will be to get in touch with contractors. We're very much looking forward to seeing this chaos turn into something beautiful, and I know we'll have something great when we're done, Blackledge said. The damage could have been much worse. Firefighters' tactical decision to use a front-end loader to open up a hallway while battling the fire may have saved part of the facility, officials said Tuesday. The first companies to arrive tried to attack the interior fire, but faced high heat and zero visibility, forcing them to withdraw, according to a joint statement from Fire Chief Jeff Hoke, Assistant Chief Stephen Page, and Clinton Public Safety Commissioner Dan Ballinger. The fire self-vented through the roof shortly after. Three ladder trucks were used for elevated master streams to fight the fire, along with several hand lines around the structure in a defensive operation, the officials said. Fire crews were able to contain the fire to the sanctuary part of the church, and the front-end loader from the city of Clinton was brought in to open up the hallway connecting the church to the gym and kitchen area. This move saved the gym and kitchen area of the church, other than some smoke throughout that building, officials said. The roof of the church collapsed during the fire and made re-entry into the structure impossible, officials said. Once the fire was under control, excavators were called in to tear down remaining areas so that firefighters could access hotspots and limit safety concerns. Fire departments from Kenny, Wapella, Maroa, Farmer City, Hayworth, Waynesville, Weldon, Argenta Oriana, Warrensburg, Decatur, Lincoln, Mount Pulaski, Bloomington, and Hickory Point assisted at the scene. Clinton Police and the DeWitt County Sheriff's Office assisted with traffic control. Several other agencies also assisted, officials said, including DeWitt County EMS, who provided assistance to personnel during the incident, the Clinton Street Department, which helped with heavy equipment, and the Clinton Water Department, which helped with water levels. The Clinton Lutheran Church gave firefighters a place to cool off and use the restrooms, and several people brought refreshments and food for first responders. Coronavirus, the state response, $900 million in rent support relief announced, evictions moratorium extended to July 31st, by Jerry Nowicki, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. Governor J.B. Pritzker announced Wednesday he will extend a moratorium on evictions in the state until July 31st, and a new state grant program that will begin in August to give assistance to those who are behind on rent. There will be $150 million dedicated to each an emergency rental assistance and emergency mortgage assistance program, which will begin in August. Those were two of several programs totaling $900 million in state aid that were highlighted in a Chicago news conference by Pritzker and legislative leaders. Today, we take another step forward in delivering Illinois much-needed support in an effort to get through this crisis and rebound with a stronger and more inclusive economy on the other side of this pandemic, Pritzker said. With assistance from the Federal CARES Act and in partnership with the General Assembly, including from the Black Caucus, Latino Caucus, and Asian Caucus, my administration has put together a support package of over $900 million to lift up small businesses, working families, and Black and Brown communities who have been hit the hardest by COVID-19 financial impacts. The rental program will be run by the Illinois Housing Development Authority and applies to those who have been unable to pay rent due to COVID-19. The program allows for grants of $5,000 to provide emergency rental assistance. Pritzker said it is expected to be running by August, lasting through the end of the year. To be eligible, a tenant must carry an unpaid rent balance from March through present day and be able to certify that COVID-19-related income loss is the reason they cannot afford rent. The governor's office anticipates the program can help approximately 30,000 renters. Assistance will be paid directly to a property owner or landlord on behalf of the tenant, and landlords accepting assistance must agree not to evict the tenant for the duration of the agreement. A similar emergency mortgage program creates grants of up to $15,000 to homeowners who need support with mortgage payments. That program also is expected to launch in August, and the governor's office anticipates it will serve approximately 10,000 people. Eligible homeowners must have had an income not exceeding 120% of the area median income prior to the pandemic, and must be able to certify that the reason they could not pay their mortgage in full was due to a COVID-19-related loss of income. Grants from both programs will be allotted on a first-applied, first-approved basis. The extension of the residential eviction ban through July 31st is an effort to give people a smooth transition into these new assistance programs, Pritzker said. Business interruption grants. The governor also announced that in early July, the State Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity will begin distributing the first $60 million installment of business interruption grants, which are funded by the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or CARES Act. The BIG program can help up to 3,500 businesses that face disruptions due to COVID-19-related closures. In all, that program will receive $540 million in funding, half of which the state has dedicated to child care providers. Small businesses that have been heavily restricted or completely shut down in areas disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 will be prioritized in the first funding wave, according to the governor's office. One-third of the first $60 million installment will go to 1,000 businesses in grants of $20,000 in areas impacted by property damage resulting from recent civil unrest. The same amount will be dedicated to 1,000 bars and restaurants unable to offer outside service. There will be $10 million dedicated to 1,000 grants of up to $10,000 for barbershops and salons, and $20 million dedicated to 500 grants of $20,000 each for gyms and fitness centers. Applications will be available on Monday, June 22nd through DCEO. Other programs. Existing Illinois Department of Human Services funding totaling $32.5 million will go toward other poverty alleviation strategies. National unrest. Officer charged with murder. Rolfe accused of shooting, kicking DUI suspect Brooks, by Kate Brumback, Associated Press, Atlanta. Prosecutors brought murder charges Wednesday against the white Atlanta police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks in the back, saying that Brooks was not a deadly threat and that the officer kicked the wounded black man and offered no medical treatment for over 2 minutes as he lay dying on the ground. Brooks was holding a stun gun he had snatched from officers, and he fired it at them during the clash, but he was running away at the time and was 18 feet 3 inches from Officer Garrett Rolfe when Rolfe started shooting, District Attorney Paul Howard said in announcing the charges. "I got him," The prosecutor quoted Rolfe as saying, "The felony murder charge against Rolfe, 27, carries life in prison or the death penalty if prosecutors decide to seek it. He was also charged with 10 other offenses punishable by decades behind bars." The decision to prosecute came less than 5 days after the killing outside a Wendy's restaurant rocked a city and a nation already roiled by the death of George Floyd under a police officer's knee in Minneapolis late last month. "We've concluded at the time that Mr. Brooks was shot that he did not pose an immediate threat of death," Howard said. A second officer, Devin Brosnan, 26, stood on Brooks' shoulder as he struggled for his life. Howard said Brosnan was charged with aggravated assault and violating his oath. The district attorney said Brosnan is cooperating with prosecutors and will testify, saying it was the first time in 40 such cases in which an officer had come forward to do so. But an attorney for Brosnan emphatically denied he had agreed to be a prosecution witness and said he was not pleading guilty to anything. Brooks' widow, Tamika Miller, said it was painful to hear the new details of what had happened to her husband in his final minutes. "I felt everything that he felt just by hearing what he went through, and it hurt. It hurt really bad," she said. In Washington, meanwhile, Senate Republicans announced the most ambitious GOP police reform package in years, including an enhanced use of force database, restrictions on chokeholds, and new commissions to study law enforcement and race. The bill is not as sweeping as a Democratic proposal set for a House vote next week, but it shows how swiftly the national debate has been transformed since Floyd's death. Elsewhere around the country, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, removed a statue of its Hey Rib mascot outside its alumni center, and Houston officials took down a figure of a Confederate soldier in a downtown park. A white suburban St. Louis police detective who was captured on video apparently hitting a black suspect with a police SUV and then kicking and punching the man was charged Wednesday with 2 counts of assault and armed criminal action. Special Prosecutor Tim Lomar announced the charges against Florissant Detective Joshua Smith, 31, who was fired June 10th. "It's situations like this that good cops hate because it makes everyone body look bad," Lomar said at a news conference. Brooks' killing Friday night sparked new demonstrations in Georgia's capital against police brutality after occasionally turbulent protests over Floyd's death had largely died down. Atlanta Police Chief Erica Shields resigned less than 24 hours after Brooks died, and the Wendy's restaurant was burned. Rolfe was fired after the shooting while Brosnan was placed on desk duty. Ahead of the district attorney's announcement, Rolfe's lawyers issued a statement saying the officer feared for his safety and that of others around him and was justified in shooting Brooks. Rolfe opened fire after hearing a sound like a gunshot and saw a flash in front of him, apparently from the taser. Mr. Brooks violently attacked 2 officers and disarmed 1 of them. When Mr. Brooks turned and pointed an object at Officer Rolfe, any officer would have reasonably believed that he intended to disarm, disable, or seriously injure him, the lawyers said. But the district attorney said the taser that Brooks held had already been fired twice and was thus empty and no longer a threat. About 50 demonstrators were gathered in the parking lot of the restaurant, now a burned shell with RIP and Rayshard spray painted on it, as the charges were announced. The news prompted a few raised fists. U.S. District Court, 21-month sentence for ex-Tower Hill treasurer by Tony Reed, Springfield. A federal judge sentenced former Tower Hill treasurer Nancy Finley to 21 months in prison Wednesday for stealing more than $200,000 from the village. Finley, 54, who lives in Pena, was also ordered to pay restitution totaling more than $261,000 to compensate for what she stole, the total including fees and other costs rung up to investigate and deal with the crime and its aftermath. Finley made no comment or apology when U.S. District Court Judge Sue E. Myerscough gave her the opportunity to speak. The judge described her crime as appalling, and a victim impact statement, read from Village President Phil Watson, said Tower Hill's finances had been devastated by Finley's systematic scheme of theft and fraud dating back years. Watson said Finley's sustained looting of the municipal coffers had starved the tiny village, population 650, of vital funds it needed to repair and maintain its water infrastructure. Now, after years of being deprived of cash Finley stole, the village is facing big bills to rebuild and replace rather than fix neglected equipment. The cost to fix and upgrade things has been much higher than the ongoing maintenance cost would have been if we'd had the funds to keep them maintained all the years the village funds had been disappearing, said Watson, 62. And he told the judge Finley may have stolen even more than the almost $250,000 identified over a period of some 7 years. But he said no one will ever know because she did such a thorough job of trashing the evidence. He described Tower Hill as full of mostly seniors living on Social Security and said her crimes impacted the already financially struggling community more than she will ever know. Finley paved the way for Wednesday's sentencing by pleading guilty February 7th to 3 counts of wire fraud. She was actually sentenced to 21 months on each count, but the sentences were ordered to run concurrently in a plea deal negotiated by her attorney, Daniel L. Fultz. Finley has been free on a $10,000 recognizance bond and was sentenced via video conference link because of health safety concerns prompted by the COVID-19 pandemic. As she learned her fate seated in a conference room in Fultz's Springfield office, Myerscough told her she was only reluctantly going along with the sentence agreement. "I believe cases like this are appalling," said the judge, who said she also believed that revised federal sentencing guidelines were too light on white-collar crime, and Finley had left devastation in her wake. "Quite frankly, if this were another time, not in the middle of a pandemic, I would reject your plea," the judge added. But Myerscough said she also respected Finley's defense lawyer and the federal prosecutor, Crystal Connie Correa, and given Finley's otherwise clean criminal record, she would accept the plea deal the attorneys worked out. She also gave Finley a break by agreeing not to impose interest on the restitution amount or additional fines. But she did impose a $100 assessment on each of the 3 counts Finley pleaded guilty to. Fultz told the court he would not try to excuse what his client had done. He said the prison sentence, at the minimum end of federal sentencing recommendations, would give Finley a chance to get out, find work, and start paying the restitution. It is unlikely in the course of her remaining work history that she'll ever be able to repay that, but at the least, she will be able to do what she can do. A quick calculation says that if Finley was able to pay $261 a month after she gets out of prison, it would take more than 83 years to make full restitution. Court documents show that Finley was hired as Tower Hill treasurer in 1998 and siphoned off money between 2009 and 2017. She used a computerized billing system to cover up her crimes while also helping herself to money from other village accounts. A grand jury indictment said she moved cash around using wire transfers, which dumped the proceeds from her thefts directly into her personal bank account. The federal case isn't Finley's only legal problem, however. She also faces a Shelby County Circuit Court theft charge of stealing more than $100,000 from the village. It has been rescheduled numerous times while the federal case proceeded and is currently set for a preliminary hearing on August 24th. But Fultz has stated previously that while he is not the attorney representing Finley in the Shelby County case, he expected the county charges to be dropped once the federal sentencing took place. Elwin Restaurant set to go out on a high note. Raspberry Room to close June 26th by Danette Beckett, Elwin. The Raspberry Room, Elwin's Tea Room Restaurant, will be closing permanently on June 26th. The owner, Kelly Garber, said the timing is right to retire from the business. "After being gone for 3 months, I figured out there's a life other than the Raspberry Room," said Garber, 64. "I want to try something else. We just decided it would be a good time not to reopen." Garber and her daughter-in-law are the main employees, but wanted to say goodbye to their customers. "Go out on a high note," Garber said. For that to happen, the business is offering cash-only curbside food service from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. Call 217-865-2916 to place an order. Check out their Facebook page of daily offerings. Virginia Bilyeu and Jeanette Ball started the business 29 years ago. Ball retired a few years ago. Bilyeu passed away in 2016. She made pies 6 weeks before she passed, Garber said. The restaurant opened in May of 1991, next door to the Elwyn Antique Mall on US 51. The antique store will remain open. The small restaurant was known for its freshly made chicken salad served on croissants, French onion soup, the house specialty munchies mix, and cream pies and other desserts. Carol Coons, 59, and her mother, Faye Meish, 80, often met at the Raspberry Room for lunch, along with other family members. "We're sad," Coons said, about the restaurant closing. "We like to come here. We love the chicken salad." Coons travels from Tower Hill to get a meal at the quaint restaurant. Her mother comes from Pena. The two made a special trip on Wednesday. "This may be the last time," Coons said. "Along with the food, the atmosphere was a draw for the family. It's kind of homey," Meish said. The owners recommend those with gift certificates use them before the closing date. Relief. 400 face shields donated to Crossing Healthcare by Danette Beckett, Decatur. A community healthcare provider on Wednesday received a boost in coronavirus protection equipment. Senator Andy Menar, Democrat of Bunker Hill, stopped by Crossing Healthcare to drop off about 400 face shields for those in the facility helping to detect the coronavirus. As a partnership with John Deere and Moline, along with United Auto Workers, they've been providing face shields as a public service, Menar said. "I wanted to make sure the good work that Crossing does gets recognized." The state senator has a special connection with Crossing Healthcare. "I love the place and the work that's done here," Menar said. "It's good work that's done here each and every day." The face shields are plastic coverings designed to protect the entire face. The Crossing Healthcare providers will utilize the shields. The facility is an Illinois Department of Public Health testing site for the coronavirus. The tents located in the back of the Crossing Healthcare building are set up to provide COVID-19 testing. "Our staff members work in the testing area," said Tanya Andrix, CEO of Crossing Healthcare. "This will help us continue with that. We go through several every single day." Crossing Healthcare serves populations hit hardest because of healthcare disparities, particularly Latino and people of color, Andrix said. Community health centers such as Crossing provide health care to underserved populations. "The facility has been available to the local community for nearly 50 years, Andrix said. "We are their health care," she said. Andrix said face shields, masks, gowns, and gloves are difficult to procure. "These supplies are not only in short supply, but costly as well," she said. "Our staff are working very hard to obtain those things." The homemade masks made of cloth are given to other Crossing patients when they enter the building. The staff wear the surgical masks. The face shield donations were appreciated by Andrix and her staff. "They will go to great use," she said. "It's a relief to have things like this donated." Local hospitals and other healthcare facilities have been accepting PPE donations since the pandemic began months ago. Before entering any of the buildings, patients and visitors are required to wear masks or face coverings. Anyone caring for a patient who is COVID-19 positive or is suspected of possibly being positive wears full personal protective equipment, PPE, including respirator, eye protection, gloves, and gowns, said Angie Muse, communications manager for Decatur Memorial Hospital. Direct care providers and other patients will wear medical-grade face masks. Cloth masks are currently utilized by non-direct patient care colleagues and visitors. According to Muse, the hospital has had supplies of all PPE throughout the pandemic. "While we appreciate the community's donations of cloth masks, we do not currently need them," she said. HSHS St. Mary's Hospital is also thankful for the community's support during the pandemic. "Right now, our PPE supplies are steady," said marketing specialist Andrew Dilbeck. But if you have PPE or would like to donate financially, please reach out to the St. Mary's Foundation at julie.moore@hshs.org or by calling 217-464-5730. Macon County sees one new COVID-19 case, by Scott Perry, Decatur. Macon County officials on Wednesday announced the confirmation of one new case of coronavirus. That brings the county's confirmed case total to 213, the crisis communication team said in its daily coronavirus update. Health officials said 149 of the confirmed cases have been released from isolation, 39 remain in home isolation, and 3 are hospitalized. The local death toll remains at 22. It is recommended that community members continue to implement social distancing and use face coverings to prevent the spread of the virus, officials said. A total of 546 new cases of COVID-19 also were reported across Illinois on Wednesday by state health officials. 87 deaths also were confirmed. Grocery store opening in Mount Pulaski. Co-op store to offer discounts on local produce, by Lenore Sabota. Mount Pulaski. Market on the Hill, a new community-owned grocery store, will open June 22nd after a year of planning and fundraising. The store on the corner of Lafayette Street and the town square will be open from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. The store will have a deli with meats and cheeses and carry a number of staple foods, as well as fresh produce, with a special effort to source products directly from nearby farms, its management said in a statement. Through September, a 20% discount will be given on all locally grown fresh produce. The discount is being made through a partnership with the Mount Pulaski Economic Development Board. The COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated food insecurity across the state and locally, said Kim Martin, head of the Health Initiative Committee for the Market on the Hill Board. Just getting the store open will provide the southern Logan County area with greater food access, but we wanted to go a step further and help people afford more of the fresh, wholesome food that is often perceived as too expensive, she said. We're doing what we can to make local produce accessible to everyone who needs it. The store is owned by 125 residents of Logan County, but shoppers don't need to be owners. A grand opening celebration will take place 6 p.m. June 26th. In addition to a ribbon cutting, there will be free light refreshments provided by Mike Richner Catering in partnership with John Wise of Prima Grills. Local ingredients will be provided by Hilltop Community Gardens and Tyson's Farm. Outdoor seating will be available, and state guidelines for social distancing will be observed during the grand opening celebration, the store's management said. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, June 18th, 2020. Please stay tuned.